Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this month's issue of Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine podcast. With you is Dr. Dania Koja. I'm an emergency physician who practices in Baltimore, Maryland, and lives pretty much all over the world.
And this is Wendy Chang, an emergency physician and neurointensivist in Baltimore, Maryland.
And this month, we're going to be discussing Critical Decisions November 2020 issue. And if you don't know what Critical Decisions in Emergency Medicine is, what are you waiting for? It is ACEP's official CME publication, and it is jam-packed with great things. Each month, we discuss two lessons. And in each lesson, we're focusing on the critical decisions that you need to think of, whether you're approaching the bread and butter of emergency medicine or things that are cutting edge.
There are also a lot of other features, such as the critical EKG, critical procedure, and as our listeners know, my favorite, the LLSA review.
And this particular issue is super special. Not only do we have a guest to discuss the second lesson, but this marks our third birthday. We have been doing this for the past 3 years, and we are incredibly grateful to ACEP for the opportunity to spend time with each other and discuss one of our favorite publications, keep our knowledge up to date, and hopefully add to your knowledge and keep you well-informed and entertained. So thank you all for listening to us for the past 3 years. And if you've enjoyed this, then please either tweet at us, reach out to us, or leave a comment on our podcast page. And speaking of the fact that we are 3 years old, this is a great segue into our first lesson that talks about pediatrics. It is called Whistle and Squeak, Pediatric Strider. Thank you to Drs. Nessie Dahan and Laura Melville, and NP Kristen Campbell for writing this article. It's November, so it's RSV respiratory illness season. So this is definitely the best time of the year to talk about pediatric airway noises because kids get noisier in the winter. So let's start with the basics with Strider. What is Strider?
So Strider, it's a good reminder for certainly all of us, as well as our less experienced listeners, that it's a high-pitched sound caused by turbulent airflow through a partially obstructed upper airway. It is more common in children than adults because, of course, kids have narrow airways. And there's a great figure in the article that shows that just a 1 millimeter narrowing increases the airway resistance by 16 times. Another great reminder is that Strider can be inspiratory, expiratory, or biphasic.
That's pretty interesting because I remember from medical school is that wheezing is expiratory and Strider is inspiratory, which is an oversimplification, it sounds. So how are we supposed to approach pediatric Strider?
Well, the age of the child can be a clue to the diagnosis, such as laryngomalacia in neonates and infants, croup or foreign body aspirations in toddlers, or a peritonsillar abscess in a school-age child. But, of course, anaphylaxis or hereditary angioedema can present at any age. So when we do have a patient who's presenting with Strider, obviously we're going to approach it with the ABCs like we do with any other acutely ill patient, obviously focusing on the A since you're dealing with an airway issue. We want to look at the patient's respiratory effort, whether there's any cyanosis or fatigue, how alert the patient is, whether there's any tripoding. And the key, I think, with kids is that you want to make sure your assessment of them doesn't worsen their condition since they can get anxious, et cetera, by, you know, potentially medical procedures. And so you want to start by observing them from a distance.
Well, not only does that avoid agitation and anxiety, it also avoids you having respiratory secretions all over you in flu season.
That's right.
So that keeps both you and your patients safe. So let's say it's a really tiny baby and you're thinking that it's laryngomalacia. What do we need to remember about that?
Well, it's the most common cause of chronic Strider in infants. And this is a process where there's collapse of the laryngeal tissues and epiglottis. That's what causes the Strider that worsens when the baby is agitated, lying supine, or feeding. Most of them outgrow this, but a few do require surgery.
Got it. So how about croup?
Well, the longer name for croup is laryngotracheal bronchitis.
Yeah, so croup. Way too many letters, Wendy.
That's right. Essentially, it's a condition that affects all the airways from the larynx all the way down to bronchus. All the symptoms can present in these ways. It's the most common cause of stridor in febrile children, with the peak incidence at 2 years. And it can be caused by many respiratory viruses, not just parainfluenza type 1, which is, you know, what shows up on your boards. Typically, there's a few days of prodromal upper respiratory symptoms and fever, and then the child develops that classic seal-like bark. It can progress to stridor and respiratory distress, which is the concern. It is a clinical diagnosis, and sometimes you might find an x-ray finding of a steeple sign.
All right. So you diagnose croup because there's a little baby that's sparking during flu season. How are you supposed to treat it?
So it's really based on the severity of symptoms, but really all of these kids will get steroids, dexamethasone. I think the question I always comes up is, when do you give racemic epi? And usually it's when there is stridor at rest that persists after the steroid, which is what the article says. If the patient improves in their symptoms after getting the racemic epi, you can observe them for 2 hours to make sure there's no rebound symptoms and then discharge them. If the patient obviously is more severe, still having stridor, still having increased work of breathing, then you're going to need to admit them for observation. You can consider Heliox since that can improve that turbulent airflow.
All right. So what other conditions do we have to consider in addition?
So other conditions that affect the airway that may be life-threatening are bacterial tracheitis and epiglottitis. Both can be caused by staph, strep, or Haemophilus, with bacterial tracheitis more often occurring as a secondary infection after a resolution of a viral illness. The age range you consider this is similar, from 6 months to 6 to 8 years or so. The key is that these kids are going to appear toxic. They can't swallow, they're drooling, they have stridor, they have respiratory distress. They could also have anterior neck pain if you're dealing with bacterial tracheitis. And if you were to get an x-ray in this patient, maybe you'll see a thumbprint sign and epiglottitis.
So how do we treat these kids?
Keep the kid and yourself calm, but they may need intubation, just depending on obviously the severity of their symptoms. And when you're choosing antibiotics, you do want to be broad. You can choose ceftriaxone and vancomycin.
And how about foreign body aspiration? Because kids are going to want to swallow everything.
Yes, exactly. Like maybe Christmas ornaments. It is most common in 1 to 3 year old, your toddler range.
So our age.
Our age, I know, exactly. But you do want to consider this in afebrile kids who develop an acute cough, dyspnea, stridor, wheezing. Obviously, foreign body aspiration can be quite life-threatening. It's the fourth leading cause of death in children less than 5 years old. And it's important to remember that x-rays may not really be helpful because most of the things that kids these age stick in their mouth and unfortunately aspirate on are radiolucent. The key in taking care of a kid who has aspirated on a foreign body is determining whether you're dealing with a partial or a complete airway obstruction. If it is a partial obstruction, the child would have their intact cough reflex and they can try to attempt to clear it out by coughing. But of course, if the child tires out or it develops into a complete airway obstruction, then you're going to have to try and clear for them. As we all remember from a head down, back slap, chest thrust in infants and then abdominal thrusts in those greater than 1 year old. If the child becomes unresponsive, then start CPR and then attempt visual removal of the foreign body. Remember, do not perform a blind finger sweep because you don't want to unintentionally lodge the foreign body further. Your choice of an airway is going to depend on where the obstruction is. You can only utilize a cricothyrotomy if the foreign body is above the vocal cord. There's an excellent algorithm in figure 6 that outlines all of this.
Well, thank you, Wendy, for taking us through these important pearls that are related to all these stridorous and noisy kids. This can definitely be nerve-wracking, especially when you don't see kids as often. These were fantastic reminders that laryngomalacia is usually something that's there before a year or two old. After that, it's not laryngomalacia, and that most kiddos just grow it out. With croup, you reminded us that it is the barking and coughing in the setting of like prodromal respiratory symptoms, and the treatment is dexamethasone. That patients that are distressed, then they can get racemic epi and be observed, and then if possible, be sent home. Definitely start antibiotics for concerns for bacterial tracheitis and epiglottitis. And the most important thing is that we need to stay calm so that they don't freak out and end up closing their entire airway. Finally, last but not least, x-rays are completely useless for foreign body aspiration if the body that they swallowed was radiolucent, which is 3/4 of the cases. So if you are concerned about a foreign body aspiration, then it's not necessarily x-ray that's going to answer your question. And blind sweeps are a bad idea.
That's right. Moving on to our critical procedure this month, it is on ankle brachial index. It's a quick, non-invasive assessment of vascular injuries. And as a reminder, if you have an ABI that's greater than 0.9, that has a high negative predictive value for vascular injuries in patients who don't have pre-existing peripheral vascular disease. The idea is that you compare the systolic blood pressure in the injured lower extremity with the systolic blood pressure in an uninjured arm, of course, using a manual blood pressure cuff and a Doppler.
This makes it sound so simple. I think that one of the things that I liked about this is, other than the pictures that they always have in the critical procedure, is that it reminds you of an important pearl, is that you should not be doing this if you're suspecting a DVT. So for our critical cases in orthopedics and trauma, this is a case of patellar subluxation. And it's a reminder that subluxation and dislocations are usually in the lateral direction. It actually happens from non-contact trauma, and the treatment is a knee immobilizer, crutches, physical therapy, and non-weight bearing. Remember that if you have a large effusion and lots of pain with a patellar subluxation or dislocation, then you should suspect an osteochondral defect. This case has a lot of very interesting imaging. Definitely take a moment and look at both x-rays and MRIs.
Very cool. For our critical image, it is a case of a patient who unfortunately had a cardiac arrest with unknown downtime after an opioid overdose. After ROSC, there was a CAT scan that was obtained, and it shows global cerebral edema with loss of gray white differentiation from the patient's hypoxic ischemic injury. And it also shows what's called a pseudosubarachnoid hemorrhage. So definitely check out that picture, because sometimes that we get consults about that, and it's actually not a subarachnoid hemorrhage, but simply increased density in the basilar cisterns from the cerebral edema. You can differentiate this by measuring the Hounsfield unit, because it is lower than when you compare it with blood. It's important to differentiate this, of course, because the management of subarachnoid hemorrhage is different than post-cardiac arrest care. And despite these findings, which might sound quite bad, the American Heart Association cautions against early withdrawal of life-sustaining treatments until further assessment is done.
Got it. Such a fantastic pearl. This month's critical EKG is actually pretty awesome. So this is a case of second degree type 1 heart block that was misdiagnosed as AFib. There's an interesting discussion under the ECG that reminds you of how to differentiate the two. And a definite reminder that you should always look for those P waves.
It is pretty hard to find the P waves.
Well, for our second lesson, we have cell theories, oncologic emergencies. Thank you to Drs. Britt Long, Drew Long, and Alex Kaufman for writing this article. And I'm super excited, and I'm sure Wendy is as well, because Dr. Long, Britt Long, is with us today. So, Britt, welcome to this podcast.
Donnie and Wendy, thank you so much for having me. I'm big fans. You guys do a tremendous job with your publication and your podcast.
Well, thank you. So why did you decide to write an article about oncologic emergencies?
We're seeing more emergencies come from cancers and their therapies, mainly because the efficacy of the oncologic therapies has improved. And this has resulted in increased patient lifespan and the number of patients who can present with complications to the ED. And when it comes to these complications, a little knowledge can really go a long way towards improving the care of these patients in the ED.
Cool. We actually talked a little bit about oncologic emergencies relatively recently, but focused really on immunotherapy. So what are we going to talk about today?
We have quite a list ahead of us. So we're going to take a quick look at SVC syndrome, malignant pericardial disease, malignant spinal cord compression, hypercalcemia, tumor lysis syndrome, leukostasis, and finally, neutropenic fever.
All right. So we're going to spend the next 6 hours talking about this, right?
Oh, I hope not.
Well, it is a lot of stuff to cover. And I think it's pretty awesome that you guys chose to focus a critical decisions article on this, because I'm sure it's just going to focus on like the must know points. So Britt, please give us your rapid fire. What do we definitely need to know about these disorders? Let's start with SVC syndrome.
SVC syndrome comes from obstruction of flow through the SVC, most commonly due to external compression from cancer. But there are also some non-malignant causes. Symptoms primarily come from that obstruction. Shortness of breath is the most common symptom, and facial swelling is the most common sign that we'll see in the ED. While most patients have gradually worsening symptoms due to development of collateral flow, those with rapid obstruction with no collateral flow can have significant airway edema. Our diagnostic modality of choice is CT chest with IV contrast, and on the CT, the presence of collaterals alone is greater than 90% sensitive and specific for the diagnosis. Treatment really rests on chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and a stent can be placed for patients with severe symptoms. Systemic anticoagulation is needed if a thrombus is present. And if there is significant airway edema, airway management will be needed.
Got it. So what about malignant pericardial disease?
This is a tough one. Malignant pericardial disease can occur in up to 1/3 of cancer patients, usually due to lung or breast cancer. But most pericardial effusions themselves are not associated with cancer, but something else. Exertional dyspnea can occur in 80% of patients, and ultrasound is your go-to imaging test. If the patient is hypotensive, provide IV fluids, and pericardiocentesis may be needed. And unfortunately, these effusions can reoccur in up to 60% of cases.
Oh, wow. That's a lot of recurrence. That's definitely something to keep in mind. How about malignant spinal cord compressions? What do we need to know about that?
Malignant spinal cord compression occurs in about 5% of cancer patients, usually due to external compression. The most common site is the thoracic spine, especially with breast and lung cancer. Prostate cancer, though, is associated with lumbar mets. None of the symptoms are 100%, but back pain can occur in over 80% of patients and is typically the first sign we'll see in the ED. Sensory or motor changes and even bowel and bladder dysfunction can occur in later stages, but again, these aren't present in all patients. Basically, you need to think about this in patients with cancer, with new back pain, worsening back pain, or those with neurologic symptoms. MRI of the whole spine is needed, as 1/3 of patients can have multiple sites with compression. Treatment includes pain control and discussion with the spine surgeon and oncologist, as well as steroids. If severe neurologic deficits are present, high-dose steroids are needed. But for patients with relatively minor neurologic symptoms, lower doses like 10 milligrams of dexamethasone can be used.
I still can't get over the fact that you just asked us to MRI the entire spine. I'm pretty sure that conversation is not going to go well with a radiologist.
No, it's not. And from experience, they're going to ask you. They'll probably call within 5 minutes of you ordering that test. But it's very important that you obtain an MRI of the whole spine.
That's a fantastic pearl.
I agree. Okay, I'm going to need the hypercalcemia treatment broken down because I always struggle with this.
Hypercalcemia can occur in up to 30% of patients with cancer. And again, it usually comes from breast cancer, lung cancer, or multiple myeloma. And it's basically broken down into different classes based on the specific number of calcium and whether there are symptoms present. So when we're talking about mild hypercalcemia, that's typically less than 12 milligrams per deciliter. Moderate is between 12 and 13.9, and severe is greater than 14. Now, we learn about the classic stones, bones, abdominal moans, and psychiatric overtones for the presentation, but we really need to think about this in those with dehydration, fatigue, confusion, nausea and vomiting, constipation, changes in any urinary output, and polydipsia. The most important test in the ED is an ECG, which can show a variety of different findings like bradycardia, prolonged PR interval, widened QRS, and even shortened QT interval. Now, back to your question, treatment really comes down to the patient's symptoms and calcium level. If the level is less than 12 and the patient really has no symptoms, they may not need immediate therapy. But for those with levels greater than 12 or significant symptoms, fluid resuscitation is the most important step, which will resolve hypercalcemia in up to 30% of cases. Other treatments we think about include things like calcitonin and bisphosphonates. Calcitonin typically works in 2 to 4 hours, while bisphosphonates take about 12 to 48 hours. Keep in mind to avoid loop diuretics, and steroids might be helpful for those with calcitriol overproduction, like those with a lymphoma. Dialysis might be needed for those with significant elevations greater than 18, new onset congestive heart failure, acute kidney injury, and neurologic deficits from the hypercalcemia.
Oh, wow. I don't think I ever thought that hypercalcemia alone could sound so dramatic, but I guess it could. What does scare me a lot more, though, than hypercalcemia is tumor lysis syndrome. What do I need to remember about that?
These patients can be very sick, and this basically comes down to massive tumor cell lysis that releases potassium, phosphorus, and uric acid. It's most common after treatment initiation for lymphomas and ALL, and it's pretty uncommon for solid tumors. Patients can present with vomiting, diarrhea, decreased urine output, and unfortunately, the dangerous complication are arrhythmias. The most common electrolyte abnormality is low calcium, but hyperkalemia is the most serious. Other findings include hyperphosphatemia and hyperuricemia. You can use the Kiro-Bishop classification system based on clinical and lab findings for diagnosis. Oncologists try to prevent this with hydration and allopurinol, but allopurinol really doesn't metabolize uric acid that is already present. Management really focuses on fluids, electrolyte correction, especially that potassium, and raspiricase, which oxidizes the uric acid to a soluble metabolite. There's not great data for urinary alkalinization with sodium bicarbonate, but hemodialysis might be needed for patients who are refractory to these other therapies I mentioned.
Got it. Those are great pearls. Now, I've always wondered how much or how high is a white blood cell concerning in oncology, I guess. And so take us through leukostasis.
Great question. And we might see some significant elevations. So just for some definitions, hyperleukocytosis occurs with white blood cells greater than 50,000. Typically, we'll see this when the white blood cells go above 100,000. Leukostasis is hyperleukocytosis with patient symptoms. The most common cancers associated with this are AML or CML with blast crisis. These cells basically obstruct the vasculature and cause tissue hypoxemia and end organ dysfunction. The most common symptoms we'll see are respiratory and neurologic symptoms, but MI, limb ischemia, and even renal disease can occur. And unfortunately, mortality is very severe, reaching 40%. 80% of these patients will have a fever. You need to closely evaluate for a source of infection and provide broad-spectrum antibiotics. Unfortunately, 40% of these patients will also have DIC. Treatment really comes down to cytoreduction with induction chemotherapy or leukapheresis while temporizing with IV fluids. Chemotherapy is the only treatment shown to improve mortality in these patients. Hydroxyurea can be used if patients are asymptomatic, but this really isn't going to be the foundation of your ED therapy. Finally, to top it all off, these patients are also at risk of tumor lysis syndrome with therapy.
But we already know how to treat tumor lysis syndrome because we just talked about it. So that's fine.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll be perfectly fine. Now, how about if they have a problem with their white blood cells because they're too low and they have a fever? So they have a neutropenic fever.
Yep, and this is our last complication. Neutropenic fever is one of the most common oncologic emergencies we're going to see, and it's defined as a single oral temperature greater than 38.3 degrees Celsius or a temperature greater than 38 for 1 hour, plus an absolute neutrophil count less than 500 or less than 1,000 with an expected decrease to less than 500. Neutropenia typically occurs 5 to 14 days after a session of chemotherapy. For these patients, you need to perform a comprehensive exam to look for a source of infection. But keep in mind that these patients often don't display the classic signs of infection because of their reduced immune function. Only 20 to 30% of these cases are actually due to infection, but we still need to provide broad-spectrum antibiotics. The most common bacterial microbes are going to be gram-positive, especially Staph epidermidis. Like I said, treat these patients with broad-spectrum antibiotics like cefepime or piperacillin tazobactam. Not all patients need vancomycin, and this is an important point. Think about adding vanc for soft tissue or skin infections, central line infections, pneumonia, mucositis, and those with hemodynamic compromise or shock. If necrotizing mucositis, an intra-abdominal or pelvic infection, sinusitis, or perirectal cellulitis is present, add anaerobic coverage. We also need to think about fungal infection in certain situations. Fungal infection is more likely in those on chronic antibiotic therapy and high number of treatment cycles, those who fail to resolve with antibiotics, and those with no clear cause of bacterial infection. When it comes to disposition, we need to take into account several different factors, but most importantly, talk with the patient's oncologist for all disposition decisions. If they're sick, it's easy. They need admission. There are two risk scores you can consider, including the MASC and CISNE scores, but again, these decisions should be made in conjunction with oncology. If you're going to discharge these patients home after IV antibiotics and ED, prescribe them ciprofloxacin plus augmentin or clindamycin.
Wow, this was a great overview, certainly, of the oncologic emergencies that we can see, as you mentioned, especially with increased lifespan, increased diagnoses of malignancy. So I've learned a lot already from your article, as well as what you talked about. I learned that with SVC syndrome, dyspnea is the most common presenting symptom, and facial swelling is the most common sign that you can see. When you get a CT for evaluation, if you find that there's collateral vessels, it is very sensitive and specific for this diagnosis. If you're dealing with a patient with a pericardial effusion that is malignant in nature, remember that these can recur in 60% of the cases. And if you're worried about a patient who has, let's say, breast or lung cancer, or even prostate, renal cell, etc., the risk is higher with these particular malignancies for a malignant spinal cord compression. And back pain might be the presenting symptom, and we always talk about red flags with back pains, but also remember that symptoms of bowel and bladder dysfunction is not present in all of these cases. So you really have to have a high index of suspicion, and you have to image the whole spine, even if the radiologist gives you pushback.
This is also a pretty great reminder that with hypercalcemia, it's IV fluids. You can add calcitonin and bisphosphonate, and definitely no loop diuretics. With tumor lysis syndrome, and those are your sick patients, you're going to give them also IV fluids and correct their electrolytes and maybe give them raspberricase if you have access to that. No alkalinization of the urine because you don't really have such good data for that. Now, leukostasis and hyperleukocytosis are two different things because in order for you to have leukostasis, you have to have high white blood cells, which is the hyperleukocytosis, but you also have to have symptoms, which is respiratory or neurologic usually. And those are treated with induction chemo or leukapheresis. And those patients have a pretty high mortality and a lot of DIC. And last but not least, neutropenic fever. With that, it's important to remember that only 30% of these patients are actually febrile because of an infection, which is why we try to be judicious with antibiotics, yet cover them with broad spectrum antibiotics at the same time. So there are patients that we can discharge, and that can be done in conjunction with oncology for patients that are low risk, and we should only add vancomycin for patients who are at risk for having MRSA, so those with soft tissue infection, central line infection, and so on. Thank you so much, Britt, for taking the time to, one, write this article with the rest of the team, but also come on this podcast and basically review the entire chapter of oncological emergencies with us. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners?
Danya and Wendy, just thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the great work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Wendy. So now to your favorite section, the LLSA review. Let's talk about opioid misuse disorder.
Definitely. There is a lot of attention right now and recently about prescribing opioids from the ED, but unfortunately not enough attention on identifying patients who have opioid use disorders and referring them to longitudinal care. So in the ED, we can try and screen these patients using a prescription drug monitoring database like we have in Maryland. Another important evidence-based tool is the COWLS tool, the Clinical Opioid Withdrawal Scale, since treatment of withdrawal can actually improve compliance with management. I heard you, Danya, as well as a lot of people recently got their medication-assisted therapy training, which is awesome.
Yep, it was pretty great, actually. So definitely shout out to ASAP that does provide that training for free if you're an ASAP member. So definitely check it out because it makes life so much easier when you have that waiver and you're able to care for these patients the way they need that care.
Yes, definitely agree. So medication-assisted therapy with buprenorphine should be the first-line treatment for patients who are having opioid withdrawal in the ED. You can provide this prescription until follow-up with their long-term management system or until follow-up within 72 hours. As you mentioned, to prescribe in the United States, you do need this special waiver from the FDA, so you can get this training from ACIP. If you don't have such a waiver, then you'd have to have the patient return to the ED to get their subsequent doses until they're able to follow up as an outpatient. And it's important to remember, buprenorphine can precipitate moderate withdrawal if it's administered before the patient actually experiences withdrawal. And don't forget to discharge all your patients with naloxone and instructions on safe use.
Thank you, Wendy, for going through this. Definitely a new direction, I think, of how we can help our patients with opioid misuse disorder. I think this is definitely a different viewpoint of caring for more of a chronic disorder in the emergency department and improving the outcome of a lot of patients doing something relatively simple.
Yes, I agree. For our drug box this month, it is the drug lasmiditan. I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly because I always get these drugs that I can't pronounce.
Yes, but they're always new drugs, so we get to make it up as we want to.
That's right. Exactly.
Lasmiditan. How about that? It makes it sound fancy. So let's talk about lasmiditan, Wendy.
Well, it's a serotonin agonist for acute migraine treatment, but not prevention. It's an oral medication, so it's super simple, and you only have to give one dose. But you do have to watch out for potential sleepiness and serotonin syndrome.
And last but not least, our tox box for this month is the sulfuryl fluoride, which is a gas that's used for termite control. The inhalation causes vomiting and diarrhea, to you, not the termites, and cough, shortness of breath, paresthesia, seizure, hypocalcemia, hypomagnesemia, and prolonged QT. Just like all exposures, start your treatment by decontaminating the patients or decon. So remove them from the place that there's all that like termite gas, disrobe them, and then manage them supportively. So correct their electrolytes, their low calcium, their low magnesium. If they are having a seizure, then give them benzos. If that's not enough, then give them phenobarb. And if they're having an arrhythmia, then give them amiodarone.
Interesting. All right.
So this concludes this month's podcast. Thank you, Wendy, for going through this issue with me. Our dear listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to us as much as we've enjoyed recording this. And we really do hope that you continue to enjoy these podcasts. We are incredibly grateful for ACIP's support and for your support, listening to us and keeping us going for the past 3 years.
Yes, and I hope after 3 years that you find our publication and podcast always informative, often enlightening, and never boring.
Please reach out to us on our Twitter handles. Mine is at Dania Koja.
Mine is at EM_NCC.
And until next month,
bye-bye.